Happy Thanksgiving and Halloweeny in betweeny. Today's guest is known for dropping more mics on digital marketing and SEO stages than almost anyone else I know. Stay tuned to find out who's heating things up on the Present Beyond Measure Show, episode 72.
Welcome to the Present Beyond Measure Show, a podcast at the intersection of analytics, data visualization, and presentation awesomeness. You'll learn the best tips, tools, and techniques for creating analytics visualizations and presentations that inspire data-driven decisions and move you forward. If you're ready to get your insights understood and acted upon, you're in the right place. And now your host, Leah Pika.
Hello, dear listener, and welcome to the 72nd episode of the Present Beyond Measure Show, the only podcast at the intersection of presentation, data visualization, storytelling, and analytics. This is the place to be if you're ready to make maximum impact and create credibility through thoughtfully presented insights and ideas. And today you're here because I have a very, very special guest who dominates international stages at digital marketing and SEO conferences around the world. And I can't wait to share all of the amazing insights this person had to say. And I am super excited about my guest as usual, but in particular, I have been trying to get this guest on this show for you for the last 3 years. So much value to offer, so many interesting experiences around presenting data in a way that's going to get you noticed. So let's not delay any longer. Let's get to it. All right, everyone. Today's guest is one of the best known and loved speakers and experts in the world of digital marketing. He's the founder of Foundation Marketing, a content marketing agency that combines data and creativity to develop and serve ambitious brands. And they provide content marketing services to organizations all over the world, ranging from fast-growing startups to consumer products to global Fortune 500 brands. And his team has launched marketing initiatives that reach millions of people around the world through SEO and social channels. And I have been hunting down this person for years now for the show. Finally, he's here. So excited. So please help me welcome our latest guest, Ross Simmons. Hello.
Hey, how are you? It's a pleasure. I'm looking forward to diving in and chatting today. I'm so excited. I know it's been a while coming, so this is exciting for me.
I know. Well, it's not like there's not been some things going on the last, year or two.
Exactly. It's been a little bit of chaos.
Exactly. So this is so exciting for me personally because I have sort of passed you as a fellow speaker at several conferences, and I was always really taken with how engaging and exciting and enlivening and passionate your sessions are. So I thought that you would be the perfect person to share.
I appreciate that.
Yeah, of course. I thought you'd be the perfect person to share not only your journey as a speaker and what you've learned and maybe some tips that can help, but also what you're seeing happening in organizations with practitioners sharing data as well, especially on the agency side.
I appreciate that. Yeah, no, I'm excited to chat with you as well. I think crossing paths amongst all of the speaker circles is always a blast, but it's good to be able to connect over a podcast and let some folks chime in and listen and hear some of the takes behind the scenes.
Exactly. Yes, love it. So let's get started with your origin story. Everyone loves superhero story. So how did you fall into this magical, mystical world of data and digital marketing? And what led you to here?
Yeah, good question. So it started for me as a young kid when I was probably fresh into high school or so. I started my first business and I started to just like go into the wonderful world of the concept of entrepreneurship. But then when I got into university, I fell into love with data because I started a fantasy football blog and I was starting to sell a handful of different affiliate sites and things like that. And I had to track the data around it. So I was selling things on sites like eBay and I needed to keep track of all of the different moving pieces. So I had to get very familiar with spreadsheets and how to move data and how to ensure that I was optimizing all of my things for search traffic and generating the right amount of leads and all of that good stuff. So that was the early days and that gave me my first taste into it, but it really just kind of was rooted into something that I kind of fell into. I mean, it wasn't something that I was obsessed with early on in many ways, but it was something that I ended up having a passion about. And I would say another key part of my founding story would be an obsession obsession early on with fantasy sports. So I had a blog all about fantasy sports. And when you are writing content on a fantasy blog, which I was doing, you have to talk about data. You have to talk about numbers. Mm-hmm. So I had to talk about how good players were doing at throwing touchdowns and how good they were doing at scoring or getting yardage and stuff like this. And I had to do calculations around all of this, but I also had to present that data in a way that was easy to digest for the fantasy community. So I was in high school, in university, writing this content on a daily basis, and it paid for a good chunk of my tuition. But in the process, while I was doing that, I think I learned a lot about data and how to communicate about it, but also my entire obsession with the internet and how it can be used as a marketing tool and get your name out there.
Wow. So I love, first of all, when these sorts of passions are born, you know, this interest is born from a particular passion, and that understanding and analyzing that data gets started from something that we just naturally love. Yeah. But I also think it's so fascinating that you had the chance to really dive into the exploring part of the role of data, but also into the explanatory part, which is really a different set of skills and processes, right?
Yeah, 100%. Like, I was forced to kind of be able to digest and kind of tinker with the data. But then I also was kind of forced, because it was a public facing blog, to elaborate and communicate all of the various elements of it. No doubt about it.
Wow, that's amazing. And then how do you think, where was the, you know, genesis of your, the phase of your career as a speaker? Like, when did you get to actually start sharing your knowledge?
Yeah, so I came across an article. Again, a lot of my pivotal time, I think, happened while I was in university. But all throughout high school, my nickname was Shy Ross. I was a very shy kid. I didn't like raising my hand. I was very quiet and timid, and not a lot. Everyone knew me as Shy Ross. Like, it's not a creative nickname, but that was what my friends called me. And then when I got into university, I came across a piece of content. I think it was a book or something. And it said, like, if you want to be successful in business, it's important to be able to do public speaking and engage with people. And those are great ways to kind of have a competitive advantage long term for a successful career. And at that moment, I was dreading it, because I was like, oh no, I'm Shy Ross. Like, I can't do public speaking. This is not something that I can do. So I was terrified, but I got comfortable with this idea of always pushing myself to get uncomfortable. So I signed up to speak at a bunch of local events. And I was going to talk about social media, because it was something that at the time was still relatively new. So I reached out to a bunch of event organizers. I threw my hat in the ring and I had to do these presentations. And I will tell you 100%, at the end of each of those presentations, I was a sweaty mess. I was drenched in sweat. I made the mistake of wearing a white shirt once, and you could see through it at the end of it. Yeah, it was a disaster. But I kept signing up, I kept doing it, and I kept continuing to push myself to get better at that craft. And now I've been able to go around the globe and do presentations on marketing. And it's all because early on I made that decision to just take a swing and try it.
You know, I resonate so much with your journey. Even though I've been a performer since I was a little kid, I consider myself an introvert when it comes to social settings where I don't really know anyone. I hate walking into a party and I don't know anybody. Yeah. It's like my worst nightmare. Similar thing, where there's something so beautiful about how you decided to recognize this edge that you have and literally take it head on. Not even like, I'll try it, but you went after organizers and understood that mistakes were made, but you just kept going at it. 100%. And I agree. There is a bit of a weird safety, I think, and also where you're not engaging everyone in conversation one-on-one. They're coming to see you to talk. Like, the invitation is there, but there's no question there's this like, it's almost like an extreme sport for introverts.
Right. It is. It is. Yeah. And even to this day, I would say, like, I still at my core have a lot of introvert tendencies, where I get a lot of energy from putting in my headphones, being alone, giving me a blank canvas, aka like an open doc or something like that, a spreadsheet, and just letting me geek out. Like, I get energy out of that time to just create and do things. But then when you go on stage, it's a different type of energy. It's like, you go up, you're doing your presentation, you deliver value to the audience, etc. But it can be exhausting at the same time. Like, I would say it's a different, it's a different type of energy drain for sure. But I do love it. I think the thrill of being on stage and connecting with people one-to-one is a powerful, powerful way to communicate and connect.
I agree with you. I actually have to be very careful about energy during speaking, where I will go back to my room and collapse after a session, because 500, 600 people that there is like some kind of taking there. But you know, what is also interesting, what's helped with that, and this is, again, all of this stuff is to help practitioners with whatever size room they're speaking to, is I try to look at as many people in the audience individually as I can.
Cool.
I try to create a one-to-one dialogue with them in my head before going up there and saying like, yeah, this is you and me.
I love it. That's awesome. Very cool.
Yeah, it works. These little things. These are the little things that actually build up to helping what some people say is a fate worse than death.
Yeah, it's
right?
True.
100%. That's the urban legend.
Yeah. My go-to is I do a downward dog before I jump on stage. And I typically also, if anyone sees me at an event, I will always have my headphones on before I go on stage. And I'm usually listening to a handful of music that kind of gets me amped up and excited to go on board. But I also listen to a recording of myself giving the same talk that I'm about to give.
Yes.
So I oftentimes will listen to that before I go up just to make sure that I have everything kind of ingrained in my mind and I'm just kind of going off of muscle memory at that point.
I'm pretty sure you have totally stolen my exact pre-presentation ritual.
I love it. I love it.
When I started public speaking, I was falling in love with this one particular album by Zane.
Cool.
No judgment, but it's a great album actually. Right. And it was just always playing in the room before I went on. And now it has to be, it is the pre like amp up music I have to hear.
I love it. I love it.
Same thing. Yeah. These rituals, this is something I teach in my workshops because a lot of times I think, especially practitioners where they're like, I don't want to be a professional speaker, but I have to do this.
Right.
There's no tool to kind of center and ground your energy. We just fly from one meeting to the next and we're bringing whatever energy we had from the last one.
Yeah.
So these tiny rituals like allow us to come back into ourselves and 100%. Be like, all right, we got this.
Yeah, for sure. This. I agree. 100%.
That's amazing. So you also obviously help brands all over the world help make better use of their data. You're not just helping with strategy, but you're also focused a lot on what the numbers are directing you to do with that. So I'm curious, when working with so many organizations, what do you think about presenting? What are practitioners getting right? And what do you think are the biggest areas they could improve on there?
Yeah, one of the biggest things that I think people make the mistake of doing when they're presenting data is getting too in the weeds of the data points itself without giving context around why this data matters. So instead of always just saying, we saw this percentage of an increase in X, Y, and Z, there's a lack of context around why that matters. So I think it's very important for people when they're delivering and communicating about data to not solely focus on the numerical number, not to stay specifically focused on a percentage change, et cetera, but what is the underlying insight that this data point is meant to tell me and show me. And maybe you need to start telling a story with data, which may be this point is important, this point is important, but when we take both of them together, we get an understanding of a bigger idea and a bigger concept. So oftentimes, I think a mistake that we get is we over focus on the numerical number, on the whole number, or whatever the figure is, without offering insight into the context or into the story that this data represents. Oftentimes people will present a number and say, we've seen a 42% increase in traffic. That's great. But why? Why did that happen?
Right.
What's the real deep reason why this is happening and occurring? Is this related to pieces of content on a certain topic? If so, that changes the entire context of that data being presented. So we saw an increase in 42% of traffic, and this was directly related to pieces of content about a certain topic. So that context makes that data point a whole lot more valuable because now you understand why that number is even something you should think about.
Right, right. One of my favorite mantras that I sort of try to repeat to myself, because I can sometimes tend to get mixed up in the nuances and the details. And as a practitioner, we don't always realize that that's not what stakeholders are looking for.
Right.
They're really busy and overwhelmed. So what I try to say is, okay, stay on the needs, not in the weeds.
Yeah, for
sure. Stay on the needs, not in the weeds, because the why speaks to why do we need this? Why do we need to know this? Is it nice to know? That's okay. You can actually share that, but you want to be clear that that's the intention, right?
For sure. I 100% agree. It's so key. For you, how do you think about the data? Do you see a mistake that you oftentimes would say folks are making?
Ooh, I love when the tables are turned. Yeah, I have a whole section of my training called visualization violations. It's actually like the most loved and hated part of my training.
Cool.
Because people are like, give it to me, but then it hurts so good, you know?
Right.
For me, the general thing I'd love to see improve is it's another why. So I believe in intentional, conscious decision making in every aspect of life. So what I find is that there's not always a good why being asked of why am I choosing this chart type for this particular kind of data?
Yeah.
So chart choosing is like a whole art and science. There's no precise exact process to it. But for example, I'll see people choosing like a tree map, but hating a pie, like down with pies.
Right.
But what's interesting is that the sentiment is changing around pies in the field because we're starting not to see any one thing as terribly right or wrong, but more as a tool that is used in the right conditions. Mm. So a pie for me is not a composition graph. Show me the composition of something.
Yeah.
It's a contrast vehicle.
Right.
It's look how much bigger this is or how much smaller this is than the rest of it.
Mm.
And then the pie is actually kind of functioning in a productive capacity. Or the big one that I see, and especially agency folks are going to not like me for this one, is dual axis charts on different scales.
Yes. Mm-hmm,
when they have different scales.
Right.
The why behind why we are using that is often, well, I need to save space. Maybe these are sort of related metrics, but the overlapping of them actually doesn't serve a particular purpose because it's not like a scatter plot where intersections mean something.
Yeah, I love it.
So I get like the world's biggest eye rolls when I drop that one. But
I love it. I love it. More people need to see that and hear it. I appreciate that. That's cool.
Yeah, it's really just like, why am I choosing this? Why am I using this color? Why am I putting a block of bullet points on here? I just want to hear that question asked more. Right.
I love it. I think that's a great takeaway. Like, it's difficult to constantly ask why you're doing things, especially when you think they're small and they don't have a massive impact. But in reality, like, everything can have a big impact. Like, the color is small thing, but actually can be a big thing when it's in a data visualization.
Simple but powerful.
Yeah, indeed, for sure. I love it. That's awesome.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I think Edward Tufte made the argument that the way that some information was presented on a PowerPoint slide led to the Challenger explosion, you know? So like whether PowerPoint, I don't actually believe PowerPoint is to blame. It's complex, but just as you said, things are simple.
Yeah.
They seem innocuous, but they're more powerful than what we think.
Love it. I agree.
Now, what about complex data? I get this question a lot where, what if I have to present really complex ideas or, you know, I really have to explain the whole predictive model? And what are some of your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think oftentimes you will have to, I think it starts by understanding your audience. Let's start with that as a initial caveat, because complex data doesn't need to mean complex message or delivery of insight. Right.
Sorry. Felt that one.
Right. But
that's
it's
a
so
meme.
True.
That's a meme.
That's it, though. I think a lot of times we feel like just because we're doing very important data and we're going into deep data sets and we're using BI and all of this stuff, that we need to come up with something very complex. When in reality, sometimes you don't need to. Like, you can just pull out a very simple visual, very simple data visualization tool. Like, you can show people the insight and the key point much easier than we need to. So start with also understanding your audience, because if I'm talking to a statistician, it's going to be a whole different dialogue and a whole different type of combo than if I'm talking to a CEO, a CMO, a CFO. These folks are going to have a tailored message with data that will be very complex, that is different. So you have to understand your audience. Like, not everybody needs to even get access to the full spreadsheet. That's a big mistake that I see oftentimes.
Here's my entire table.
And you don't need to do that. You don't need to do that. Like, you have to lean heavily into understanding your audience and not making the mistake that complex data doesn't mean complex delivery of that data.
Oh man, that is so memeable.
It is memeing that.
I love it. It's so true. It really distills down some, I think, my whole philosophy has been trying to find, you know.
Yeah.
It's so important to remember that our audience is not you.
Right.
Our audience is not you. And they're also not each other. They have different languages, different ways of interpreting things, different biases, different things that work just based on who they are. And, you know, I have this kind of my way of trying to explain complex things is analogies. And one just literally popped in my head as you were talking, where I think of like an electronic toothbrush. Mm. I want to buy a toothbrush.
Right.
I want it to clean my teeth.
Right.
I have no idea how complex that toothbrush is with the sonic vibrations and the and the charging and all that stuff. Does it clean my teeth?
Right.
Effectively.
That's it. That's the outcome.
I love this. Ooh, I'm loving this conversation. You know, when you're thinking about how to help practitioners showcase their data, what are some of the favorite resources where they can just get started? Like what were helpful to you maybe?
Yeah. So there's a book. Oh, I'm losing it. What was that book called? There is a book that I have.
Is it my book coming out next year?
That might be it. We can go with that. But I am a big believer in books. Like, there's a lot of books over the years that I have read. Storytelling with Data, which is one that I read many moons ago. There was one that I would say had the most impact on my life, and I can't remember what it was called. So
clearly, big impact.
I know, right? It's funny. It's one of those books where I don't know the author's name. I can remember what the cover looks like. And I went into that book multiple times and used it.
Interesting.
But I can't remember what it was. Oh, Presentation Zen. I think it was called Presentation.
Oh, yes, of course.
That is exactly what it was.
That is the book that started my journey too.
It was many moons ago, but Presentation Zen, that was the one. And it was Gar Reynolds.
Exactly. Yeah, he was a past guest on the show, which was really kind of like a career-making moment, because that book, you know, for me, maybe you and so many, was sort of the gateway to understanding there was a way to doing this that wasn't the way we were all used to.
Exactly. And that one definitely changed my perspective. I remember when I read it the first time, I was in an agency that was more traditional, and they had their way of doing presentations, and they were always filled with lots of words. They had lots of tables and spreadsheets, etc. And then I came across that book, and I was like, okay, I can switch things up a little bit and apply some of the lessons here to my presentations. Yeah. And then, unfortunately, or fortunately, because it allowed me to keep the job, I became the presentation guy in the office. So whenever someone wanted their presentation to look good and be easy to understand, they would say, Ross, can you do this? Can you take it and turn it into something? But that book in particular definitely stands out as a resource that I said was very beneficial. And I would say another resource, which is not as popular today, is SlideShare. So SlideShare in the early days was very, very, very popular in the business community. It has since kind of tumbled in terms of its popularity, but they have a ton of valuable resources on there still to this day that are just presentations from people who understand data visualization, talking about how to do it well. And I would advise anyone who's listening, who's interested in data visualization, anyone who's listening, interested in storytelling with data, check out SlideShare and go in through the archives. I think there's a ton of value in there that you can use. And then another one, I think it was called How to Lie with Statistics, with Daryl Huff. That book was eye-opening. It's a bit funny. It's a bit hilarious at the same time.
I think it's in my shelf somewhere. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a good one. That's a fun book, but it also is very interesting.
I'm sure it's confronting because we don't always know how when we present data, are we showing the whole story? Are we manipulating the story? A similar book to that is How Charts Lie by Professor Alberto Cairo, who I had on the show too. That one was so timely as well in terms of analyzing how the media takes liberties with certain networks.
And it's scary because we all have the ability in our work to do the same thing. And when you're good, and this is very much not what I recommend, but when you're good, you can make data sound really good, even when it doesn't tell the whole story. Whether it's talking about an average, whether it's taking a very small sample size and not mentioning the sample size of the chart, all of those things can be manipulated to tell a story in a way that from a headline, we'll get a lot of clicks, get a lot of engagement, but in reality, doesn't matter that much. It's something that I think a lot of people need to think about, even just as humans, as we browse the internet and we are seeing tons and tons of news and media being spread around. Don't be afraid to look at where the data source actually came from and how that data came to life that is making up that headline that 1 in 3 X, Y, and Z believe in ABC. Make sure you know if that 1 in 3 wasn't just a sample of people in the office at that company.
Right, exactly. Even looking at sample size or checking a study that shares any kind of conflicts of interest or limitations of the study, just because something is published definitely doesn't mean that it should check every box on fully trusting everything about it. That's been a big lesson in the last few years, especially.
Yeah, 100%.
This really comes down also to ethics. One of the books that changed my life is Good Charts by Scott Baronato. I think I mention it almost every time. But he had a whole section on ethics of communication and that it's mostly gray area. There aren't a lot of guardrails and you just have to ask yourself, if I am manipulating or changing this view, why am I doing that?
Yeah.
Could this hold up in a court of law if it were cross-examined, or is it going to fall apart?
No, I think that's a great one. I think I'm going to have to check that piece out. I've never read that book, but I'm gonna dive into it. Yeah, I will check
that out. To your point before about presentations, and I think one of the reasons why that book has been such a watershed moment for so many presenters is that for me, when I read it, I was like, this is the audience's Bill of Rights. This is what I deserve as an audience because I'm so tired of falling asleep and being bored to tears. And
And not seeing, and you don't want to squint your eyes at every presentation. Like you don't really want to be that uncomfortable, but a lot of times people force that on you when you're in their presentation. So I love that book. I thought it was, and it's very old, but it's good.
Yeah, it's standing the test of time for sure.
It's 100%.
So there's this whole different, these are two different avenues of presenting data. You know, there's telling data stories for clients, internal projects. There's also public facing content. You know, were interested in sharing a little bit of thought around how do you distinguish those things? What are those different purposes?
Yeah. So there's, it's often overestimated how different the two things are, right? Like the data that you share publicly, you want to create and push out data that has an interesting point that is worth sharing. And content that is worth sharing is going to be a data point or a stat or something that essentially does a few things for people. It ultimately is going to move them emotionally where they're going to feel like, oh, this is something that I want to share with people because I think it's important for them to know. Somebody might view that piece of content and say, oh, I need to share this because it's going to add value to somebody who I know, something like that. You want to really put yourself into the shoes of the people you're trying to reach when it comes to the data. There was a study done by the New York Times many moons ago around why people share content online. And when you're thinking about the data that you publish publicly, I think you should apply those same thinking and methodologies to the data that you're pressing publish on. So what they said were that the motivations include to bring value and entertaining content to others. So if the stat if the statistics, if the data that you have published publicly will offer value and is entertaining to other people, people are more likely to share that. If the data helps people define themselves to others, they're more likely to share that. So if, for example, there was a data piece that said people who live in a certain region are better at X, Y, and Z, all of those people who live in that region are going to share that data because it allows them to define themselves as being someone from that region who is also really good at X, Y, Z. Many years ago, there was a data piece that came out around people with iPhones make better partners. Guess what? Everyone with an iPhone did. They shared that data because they wanted to define themselves to everyone as a great partner. We also share content to grow and nourish our relationships. So somebody who owns an iPhone might send that to the person that they're attracted to and that they're trying to date because they want to grow that relationship. And it's going to also
building the case.
Exactly. It'll make the case for them. We also share content that will provide us with self-fulfillment. So data that helps us feel good. So if we are sharing a piece of content that helps us feel good about the world, for example, let's say there was a statistic that showed that the world is just getting better and better and better for certain groups, blah, blah, blah. You are working at a company, an organization that is helping do something there. That's going to offer you self-fulfillment. And then the final one in their study was data and stories that get the word out about a cause that they believe in. So one of the most heavily shared data points is oftentimes things where you can see and feel your emotions being connected to the data. So there was a great data visualization effort done a few years back where it was called essentially how many modern day slaves are working for you. I forget who created this piece, but essentially you could go in and you could say how many different products you bought, where they were from, etc. And they would give you data on how many people working in third world countries that were not getting paid were actually probably contributing to your way of life. And that piece of content got millions and millions of shares because it ultimately allowed people to get the word out about a cause that they believed in, and the data solidified that. So one of the things that I think when you're sharing content and data publicly that you need to be thinking about are the motivations that the data will trigger and activate in other people to actually share that data with other folks. When it comes to internal data, however, it's a whole different ballgame. You are trying to truly just communicate and give insight and perspective on certain things that you're doing, while on the public facing side, you're trying to actually shape culture and motivate people and inspire people in a different way.
Wow. That was so incredibly insightful. It's interesting. I feel there are a lot of similarities to thinking about the same intentions for internal as well. Like anytime you're going, it's back to that. What is your why? What is your intention? It's asking why.
It's true.
That is really fascinating about helping people solidify their identity, getting excited about that, and also galvanizing them into a cause that makes sense. You know, when a lot of really tricky things were happening last year, especially around George Floyd. And I was starting to like take the wool off of my own eyes of things and, and realize just how little I knew about all of this. I remember there was a visualization, we actually profiled it on a previous episode, of a person who was looking at census data overlaid geographically and seeing different colorations based on race. And starting to see, she came across these very strange clumps with very clear outlines, like jagged shaped outlines in areas that had predominantly white populations, but that were heavily Black and Latino. And she realized they were prisons.
Oh, wow.
When she had that realization, the way that she told this story visually, I had chills go through my entire body because I had just watched 13th, the documentary, and I was like, oh, this is, wow, this is an such an easy thing to ignore.
Yeah, that's the power of data visualization, right? Like it can connect with you on an emotional level. And I think that's a lot. There's a lot there for folks to remember. It's like the work that you do and the way that you deliver your data can actually have a meaningful impact to shape the way people think. So it's nothing to take lightly, for sure.
it's fascinating to hear, and it is a good reminder for when people want to share that in the world about the effects that they can create.
Yeah.
And also, you know, keep that in mind.
Definitely.
How amazing. So when you're looking at sharing data internally, one of the most common questions I get is, how do people tell stories across different marketing channels? Mm. And then how do you drive results from that? Yeah. And how do you make it all make sense?
Right.
And, I'd love to hear your take.
It's definitely not easy to do. But I think it starts with, again, understanding the audience that you're trying to connect with. Understand the fact that, like, someone who is an SEO will have a whole different perspective and understanding of when you're talking about SERP data and when you're talking about a handful of things happening within inside of a keyword dashboard than somebody who is a account manager or a project manager or someone who is just purely managing a relationship with a client. And you have to ensure that the data that you're sharing with them has that relevance to them. From there, though, I think you have to also recognize that when you're presenting data from different channels, all of the channels, for the most part, should be trying to accomplish one specific goal. And when you understand what the client's goal is and what the client is looking to accomplish, the data stories that you tell should ultimately only be considered relevant if they go back to that goal. It's very easy to get caught up in the idea of geeking out about all of the things that we as marketers love to talk about, open rates, click-through rates, all of these different things. But if the only goal that the person who we're trying to connect with and talk to cares about is revenue or sales or the actual number of subscribers, then focus your data points on those and tell a story that helps them understand why some of those data points that you're talking about might even matter to them or should matter to them. And if they don't matter, don't bring them to them because you're just wasting time trying to communicate data that they don't actually care about. So my advice would always be start with the goal for what you are trying to do on those channels and then communicate it to people as it relates to that number one goal that you're looking to accomplish.
There's this idea, I read it in Nancy Duarte's Data Story, which is another excellent read, where she said that ultimately decision makers care about three main things, money, market, and exposure. And they want to turn the dial up or down in certain respects. But when you are talking about what's at stake, if there's a decision made or not made, what are the stakes being presented by the data? If it's not ascribed in one of these three things that are the level that they are speaking at, it's just going to fall flat because they're not connecting to why that's important to them, 100%. As you're saying.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. I love it. I'm going to share that part with the team so they can see it and digest it as well. I love it.
And do you ever see conflicts arise between different departments who want to have their program take the credit for the sale and how is attribution often like a political discussion sometimes?
Yeah, it's not really. Like, sometimes I think people will try to overcompensate for results by kind of like saying, no, this was directly related to X, Y, and Z. But for the most part, for us, we don't really run into it that often. The only time in which we would run into it is potentially with other partners who are trying to say, like, their data, their efforts are saying something completely different from ours. And in those situations, it's typically just a communications challenge that we need to overcome, where maybe we're not all running off of the same data sources, or maybe we're not interpreting the data the same way. But I'm a big believer that communication can solve all problems. And oftentimes that's what the issue is. It's usually just a lack of communication or miscommunication.
That's another memeable meme.
That is fair. That is fair.
All problems are actually miscommunication. I love that. Yeah, it's really about everyone just getting in a space to be open and curious and hear what each side needs and desires, right? Yeah. And that's what collaboration is. That's fantastic.
100%.
So I have one more question and then we're going to transition a bit. I did a little stalking on YouTube and I found one of your talks where you opened with this awesome, what I call story loop,
yes,
which is like a story opens and you are it's like impossible for you to not want to close it.
I love it.
It's like a powerful method for emails, right. Email subject lines and things like that. But you said, I have a confession.
Right.
And I was like, oh, so good.
Right. Yes. That is.
No one is leaving.
No, it's true. It is true. Yeah. I love that starting point. You can find a lot of trends in the way that I deliver my presentations. They oftentimes do start with a story and some type of connection to something that has happened that has nothing to do with business or life or business or marketing, but all to do with life. And it definitely is something that I leverage in every presentation because it gets people to kind of think, oh, this is different. Like most presentations go right into the marketing side, but I typically will start with that confession or something of that nature and then take people into a glimpse of who is this guy, what's he like, etc. And then I connect it back to marketing and tell that story. But it's a methodology that I've been tinkering with and it definitely works well.
Wow, I'm going to have to think about that strategy. I have tended to start with stories that are, or quotes that are related to things, or a story that I'm telling them that is designed to resonate with them, but it's about the subject.
Yep.
But I've never started with a story that didn't seem to be related. And that's even another way to create anticipation and attention, because you're like, wait a minute, what does this have to do with SEO?
Exactly. Yeah. Like I've given presentations where at first I'm talking about butter. I've given presentations where I'm talking about the Scholastic Book Fair and how amazing it was. I have presentations where I talk about how back in the day I used to draw comics and I wanted to be a superhero. So I oftentimes will use a lot of those stories up front. And one of my superpowers that I'm going to share with folks, and hopefully not everyone steals it, because I do think it allows me to, for the most part, guarantee pretty much high top three ratings after I give
it's your value prop.
Which is you tap into nostalgia. You tap into nostalgia. Hmm. So as soon as I say Scholastic Book Fair, any kid or person who still has a kid at heart, connects to that idea and they go back into time a little bit. And in another presentation, I talk about pizza pockets. I talk about all of these things that a lot of folks would have enjoyed and experienced when they were younger. And by taking people back into time to nostalgia and have those feelings, it just always resonates in a meaningful way.
Oh man, my neurons are firing right now. I'm seeing like a start. Like, I remember the day I walked out of the Matrix.
That's the same. Exactly.
No one listening can take that, by the way. That's funny. But no, I understand. Like, it's these little signature things, but that just hits on so many notes of not just generating these feel good feelings, but also creating a connection with you. Like, I'm like this. This is how I'm like this person.
Exactly. Yeah.
Where so many presentations, you feel like there's this distance between this lofty expert and wherever you are. And brilliant stuff. Yeah. Brilliant. All right, so we have entered the next segment, which is called The Upgrade, which is a tool, a resource, a book, although you've dropped a few, but anything that you think would really level up the practitioner presenter's game or something really cool to check out. We love the tools. So what do you got?
I'm going to give you a tool that is relatively new over the last year or so, but it's great. It's called Loom. So Loom. So what Loom is, it's essentially kind of like Zoom, except it's a screen and video recording tool that allows you to take data, take presentations, for example, talk to them, share your screen, walk through them, etc., and then communicate it to someone asynchronously. So it allows you to kind of record a video with your camera on while sharing your screen. You can talk through what you're seeing. You can essentially give a presentation to someone without actually doing it synchronously. And in the world of remote work and hybrid work, Loom has been a great tool for us at Foundation, but I also think it's a cool company and they do some awesome work. Another one that is very popular and a lot of people will know is Canva. I think Canva is a great tool for data visualization, and you can use it to take your data and turn it into something awesome as well. So I would throw those two tools as being some great ones that folks should check out.
Absolutely. With Canva, I actually feel like I upgraded my slide design skills just by going through the Canva design school. They really teach a lot of great basics for design, and definitely improve things. And with Loom, I use Loom as well, but not for that capacity. And I've often wondered, when we're sending the pre-read to clients and we're sending the whole deck, which is like sending the script from a movie to someone who's going to see the movie the next day, without many pieces of context and things, that does seem like a fantastic way to either transmit the data that way and make the person feel connection, or even just preview and make that connection beforehand. Wow.
I agree. Yeah. No, we use them all the time when we're delivering things to clients and partners. It's a great way to add a face to the data and a face to the content that you're delivering.
Which is so important with this still very virtual phase we're in.
Yeah, exactly. Very 100%.
All right. So we've arrived at our final mystery question. So think very hard here. Imagine this very plausible scenario. You are crossing the finish line of the World Rowing Championship when you suddenly get pulled into a whirlpool vortex that pulls you back to the moment you're about to deliver your first presentation. So what are you presenting about, if you remember, and what advice would you give to that person?
So the presentation was called The Recipe for Social Media Success.
Ooh.
I would tell myself to change your shirt.
Is that the white shirt one?
Put on a darker shirt. That would be my advice. Yeah.
There's an interesting dialogue around attire, right? In the presenting world of, you know, oh, it's supposed to be super casual. Everyone should feel so relaxed. Right. And sometimes that's even like a speaker's signature, and I think that's great. But I know for me personally, when I wear attire in a way that I feel super comfortable in, but also I feel kind of respects that I want to bring the best, I have found that that's a better sweet spot. But being mindful,
100%, I agree.
Is important.
I typically have a presentation like signature with the suspenders. It's oftentimes like my go-to a lot of events. Yeah.
I love that. Yep. So just being mindful of your whole projection, right? Your whole presentation. Oh, I can't believe how fast this time went. This was so fun and insightful, but unfortunately our time has run out. So please tell the listeners where they can keep up with you.
Yeah, I'd love to connect with everyone. You can find me on all of your favorite social media platforms. I'm pretty much on all of them. I'm at The Coolest Cool on the majority, or you can just do a quick search for Ross Simmons. If you add me to LinkedIn, just send me a connection request and I'd be sure to connect with you over there as well. And Leah, thanks so much for having me on. It's been a blast chatting with you, and I hope your listeners got some value out of our chat today.
Oh, I know that they will get so much value. I know I did. I was like, I'm like asking for a friend, taking notes. That's awesome. It was really fantastic. And you've made it really clear why you are such an in-demand speaker, but also that you come from this background of data and exploration. So you're really showing what's possible for someone who wants that sort of career in thought leader and expertise. And I truly hope our paths will cross, but this time we'll actually talk to each other at one of our shows.
I'm sure it will happen. I'm sure it will happen for sure. I love you. Well, thanks again for having me.
Thank you. Appreciate you. All right. Wow. I am still tingling from so many insights in this episode. Clearly, he has mastered this game. And I think what he mentioned at the end is so important. Observe speakers that really speak to you and engage you and light you up, and look at what they're doing and then emulate. That's so much the name of the game here in becoming a really masterful speaker. So to catch all of the links to all of the resources mentioned for linking up with Ross and registering for events and my webinar, visit the show notes page at leahpica.com/072. I would love if you could leave me a comment or suggestions, because I want to hear about the challenges you face when you're presenting your vital data stories. And if you like what you've heard, please just hop on over to Apple Podcasts or Spotify, wherever you're listening to this. Just hit that follow button. And if you could, please leave a rating and review, because they are so appreciated for helping me get this content out to practitioners like you. And I'll leave you with today's presentation inspiration by Mr. Albert Einstein. And that is, strive not to be a success, but rather to be of value. Ooh, what this episode truly locked in for me is what it means to do things with intention, with conscious choice, asking why. Why am I doing things this way? The why of being successful, well, that could work for you, but I wholeheartedly agree with Albert and Ross that if we make the why about being of value to the ones that our data stories are meant to serve, we will be successful 100% of the time. That's it for today. As we begin the steep ramp up into the holidays, I wish for you to experience what I consider to be the greatest gift of all, gratitude and thankfulness. Stay well, stay safe, and namaste.